This is the Reading Instruction Show. I am your host, Dr. Andy Johnson. The topic of today's podcast is about reading instruction and think tanks and having differences and other stuff like that. And let's just jump right into it and see if we can learn a little something today. Now, humans are a most interesting species. We walk around with some of the nuttiest ideas bouncing around in our head. But according to the Education Science Reform Act of 2002, the ideas in our head cannot be said to exist because they're not based on, quote, systematic empirical methods that draw on observation or experiment, unquote. So, it's more accurate to say that we walk around with a variety of types of electrical activities in our cerebral cortex. Neurons connect with other neurons to form and strengthen neural pathways. And neural networks are activated and expand to create some pretty interesting networks. And if we really want to use empirical methods drawn on observation or experiment as our ontological standard, we might even say that humans are merely skin bags full of chemicals sloshing about. But sometimes the chemicals are a little off. They may be too much of one thing and not enough of the other. And when this happens, the neural networks branch off in unintended directions. Other times we pour, inject, smoke, or ingest various chemicals into our skin bags. And when this happens, our neural networks can come up with all sorts of shit. Which is a long-winded way of saying that people hold a variety of positions related to reading instruction. A natural human tendency. It seems that whenever a person takes a position on something, there's this natural human tendency to want to go out into the world and convince others of the rightness of their views and the wrongness of others. We insist that if they just had our knowledge and could see things our way, they'd understand and all the problems would be solved. It's so simple, really. We just get the knowledge in our heads into their heads. Then they would see things the right way, which is our way, and the problem would be solved. So we spend our time talking. We talk loudly. We talk a lot. We talk over people. We talk and talk and talk. And I admit that I am as guilty of this as the next person regarding this natural human tendency. I am convinced that people who have vastly differing ideas from me are misguided and full of baloney. But at the same time, I realize that they're convinced of the same about me. And it's all good. Like frogs in a pond, having differing views on things can be a sign of a healthy academic ecosystem, but only if the entities within the system are willing to listen to differing ideas and continually reflect on and evaluate their own. This is what enables us to evolve our thinking. Now, differences become problematic when people create bubbles around themselves to insulate their group from all these, quote, bad ideas. This results in an inbreeding of ideas that can lead to some rather disturbing mutations. And you ask, are we talking about politics, religion, or reading instruction? And I would say all of the above. Academic discourse. In academia, having differing ideas about things is a good thing. The greater academy is based on having differing ideas followed by argument. And as stated before, argument here is not the yelling, disagreeing kind. Rather, it's the academic kind, where you state your case and support your position using reason and research. We don't try to silence opposing ideas. We don't try to demean opposing ideas. We let our ideas carry the day, not the volume of our voices or the harshness of our words. And this has worked pretty well in academia. You put forth an idea and you expect lively discussion. And at the end of the day, the idea is supported or rejected. Within the academy at large, you conduct research or write an academic article and submit it to a jury of your peers. These are experts in your field who do a blind peer review. This means your name is removed from the article, so the jury won't know who wrote it. And the names of the jury are concealed as well. And it's either accepted or rejected based on the quality of your work. And if it's accepted, it will be published. It then becomes available to all in the field, who then can conduct research or write articles to either support or refute your ideas. The same process is used for conference presentations and book contracts. Your work becomes public. People react to your ideas using research and reason. Then they go on to make careers explaining to other people how right or wrong you are. However, they do this using reason and research. And it was a pretty good system until it wasn't. Today, the words of a journalist carry more weight than that of a serious scholar in the field. Journalists are even invited to speak at academic conferences. What's up with that? The reading wars. As stated before, there never was a reading war in the academic field known as literacy instruction. The term reading wars was coined by the media. Now, you might see this term used in academic circles today, but it originated outside the field of literacy instruction. There wasn't a reading war until the media decided they wanted to invent one. Instead, there was a natural clash of theories as psycholinguistic reading theory began to emerge and expand in the 70s and 80s. And like all theories, this new theory didn't show up fully formed. It took a while for it to grow and to take shape. And it continues to evolve to this day as new research knowledge is generated. Now let's take a look at Basils. This new emerging theory began to crowd out the behavioral learning theories of the day, which were used to support a Basil approach to reading instruction. And a Basil is the name used for a teacher's manual for reading instruction. It's called a Basil because it was originally designed to deliver a base level of reading instruction. And when I started teaching second grade in 1983, teachers were given Basils. We used our Basils to deliver a scripted reading program to students who sat passively at kidney-shaped tables so they could be learned at. Learning was something we did to children, not something children did. These Basil reading programs contained a variety of skill and drill activities, round-robin read-alouds, an approved canon of leveled stories, and comprehension questions focusing on the recall of story details. And sadly, the current science of reading mandates have us rushing forward to the past. In 1983, I followed the Basel and taught all the skills. I met all my behavioral objectives. The students completed all the worksheets, and most of them passed the end of the unit test. And I thought I was a good reading teacher because I was doing what the teacher's manual told me to do. And it wasn't until I saw a good reading workshop classroom that I realized how incredibly wrong I was. Meaning-based approaches. Theories aren't designed to be eternal entities. They exist for as long as they continue to explain facts and help us understand phenomena. Then they either evolve or slowly fade away. And it's natural to have multiple explanations of the same thing. This does not mean there's a war. It means there's an academic discussion going on. Bottom-up theories of reading and behavioral learning theories began to be replaced by interactive reading theories, psycholinguistic reading theories, and constructivist learning theories. These resulted in a variety of meaning-based approaches to literacy instruction, such as reading workshop, writing workshop, and literature-based reading instruction. And not only were these effective, but they were infinitely more enjoyable for teachers and students. And they did not cause scores to go down. And when I say this, the usual response is, "Oh yeah? Well, show me the research." And I say, "So show you the research for what? Show me the research that proves that whole language didn't cause reading scores to go down." Well, first, you can't disprove a negative through research. Second, a single study or even a couple of studies doesn't prove anything. That's a simplistic understanding of research. Third, there is no the research that's read like a holy canon. Fourth, we've been showing you the research all along, but anecdotal evidence and journalists have a louder voice than a body of research and research scholars. Fifth, the proposition that whole language caused reading scores to go down, that was the proposition. The onus is on the proposition maker to support it. And sixth, searching for causes by making random correlations to things occurring at the same time is superstition, not science. Again, there never was a reading war. A war assumes there are two armies meeting on a field of battle, and this didn't happen. But there was a reading coup. There was a hostile takeover of the field of literacy instruction by profiteers who saw public education as their own private ATM machine. This group of profiteers is part of the educational industrial complex. And it includes Cambria-Lexia Learning, Pearson Education, Cengage Learning, McGraw-Hill Education, Voyager-Sopris Learning, TAL Education Group, Bright Horizons, and such. Their armies of well-paid toadies, or consultants, promise schools simple solutions to complex problems. Just buy our shiny new products, they say. Pay for our services, they say. Get trained by our experts, they say. And all your literacy problems will go away. All your students will be reading above grade level. Well, I don't know, the school says. That's a lot of money. Look, they say, look at all the colorful charts and graphs. Look at all the pretty, pretty numbers. Well, the school says, you do have numbers. That must mean the real. Wouldn't you like to have colorful charts and graphs like this? Wouldn't you like that? Wouldn't you like to have pretty, pretty numbers? Yes, the school says, yes, I would. And that, my friends, is how education lost its soul. Think tanks, the hostile takeover of literacy instruction, also included those who wanted to control public education for their own political or philosophical purposes. These includes conservative organizations such as American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, Brookings Institute, Rand Corporation, and the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. However, there can't be a lot of thinking going on in these think tanks if you're expected to come to predetermined conclusions about things. For all their questions, they have a predetermined list of answers. For all their problems, they have a predetermined list of solutions. These include privatization, testing, accountability, competition, mandated curriculum, mandated teaching strategies and approaches, getting rid of unions, parental control, charter schools, prayer in the school, vouchers, and the Ten Commandments. These think tanks fund nonprofit organizations, who then claim their nonprofit status as a badge of objectivity. However, these nonprofit organizations would lose their special funding friends in a heartbeat if their think tanks didn't bark like trained seals. Now let's look at the Education Science Reform Act. In the 80s and 90s, there was an influx of qualitative research in education. Brian Camborn, Shirley Bryce Heath, and others helped us go beyond the numbers to understand the people behind the numbers. The lens of qualitative research enabled us to see things that simply were not visible when looking through the narrow lens of controlled experimental research. Instead of measuring, quantifying, and comparing, qualitative researchers used observations, interviews, action research, surveys, ethnographies, grounded theory, case studies, and phenomenology. The result was that real people began to appear on the pages of our academic journals. These real people were much more than pre- and post-test numbers. The real people move from being subjects to participants. And the quiet voices of teachers, students, and parents began to be heard. As the Who's in Whoville said in Horton Hears a Who, "We are here." The rich conversations that were taking place within the academy in the 90s were disrupted by the Education Science Reform Act of 2002. The federal government made a decree declaring what research in education must be. The result was a narrow, parochial view of educational research. Only knowledge generated by controlled experimental research was counted as valid. Only projects and programs supported by this very restricted view of educational research would be funded. It wasn't long before the Who's and Whoville were squashed by a giant federal Grinch foot. The Education Science Reform Act of 2002 represents a simplistic understanding of research in the social sciences. It says that research methods used to study bacteria in a petri dish must be used to study children in a classroom. Controlled experimental studies is the only way of establishing causal relationships, it says. And the result was that researchers began asking only questions that could be answered by controlled experimental research. Questions like, is this thing better than that thing? And does this thing make scores go up? The frogs are no longer chirping in the ponds. We don't have the healthy academic ecosystem we once had. This has been the Reading Instruction Show. I'm your host, Dr. Andy Johnson. Yeah.